Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, a special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, with me, as always, on this Sunday. Well, Friday morning, but we're pretending Sunday, isn't it?
We can pretend it's Sunday.
Theatre of the mind, dude. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, I'm as good as I was when we finished the last podcast 2 days ago, or in radio time, about 30 seconds.
Mm.
We love mailbag, don't we?
I don't like you. Next time, you've got to tell me beforehand. I'm going to get two bottles of water instead of one. And today, I see you don't even have your Coke Zero.
Oh, mate, tell you
what's
what.
What's going on?
I'm struggling. I'm going to keep it up. Vibe is interesting, as Richie Beno would say, at least via the guys of the 12th Man. Yes, welcome back. Shouldn't really do that. All right. We've got a lot of mailbag to get through, mate. This is all mailbag all the time. If you don't care about what your fellow listeners care about, then you can switch off now and come back on Tuesday for Money Hacks. If you do care, maybe you've asked us a question, or maybe you just care about what other people are asking about. That's what I love about mailbag, mate. The politicians have this rule that if you get a letter from a constituent, then probably 1,000 other people think the same thing. And I reckon, we hope, that's the same with mailbag. Not only does it give us a chance to answer some specific questions, but share a bit of investing kind of education and goodness and just thoughts around it, which hopefully help other people as well.
I'm a bit disappointed right now.
Oh, dear. Can we start on a downer?
No, because you've just...
You're in fine form last week.
Well, but just because you've compared us to politicians. Like, pick something else. Like... Compare me to a policeman.
So are you Scott Morrison or are you Anthony Albanese in this partnership here?
I'm neither. I'd rather be a cop. I want to be a cop here. I don't want to be.
Mate, impersonating a police officer carries a jail term, I'm pretty sure. So you do that. I'm going to be a politician just because I want to stay out of jail. But I do understand your point. So if the
I am not being Scott. I'm not that Scott.
Well, we'll edit that out, and we'll place it with, hey, so radio station gets one letter, they think, no, anyway, we'll just move on.
Yeah, that's
all right. First question, mate, comes from, speaking of Scott, first question comes from Scott Hunter on, I think this was Facebook, based on the copy-paste I've done here. We copy and paste into a document so we can keep track of all the different questions from all the different socials, and I think this one's from Facebook. Scott says, hi, guys, a question for your podcast. Now, Scott doesn't start with any praise or... You know, kind of salutations. And
yeah, I know. And I'm really confused about that Scott, this Scott, that Scott, this Scott. And I mean, you know, I'm like
This is not ScoMo for the record, if anyone's wondering. This is not ScoMo after free financial advice. Happy to provide it, Scott, if you're listening. And look, Scott Morrison's got to listen, doesn't he?
I'm very happy to provide
What else would Scott Morrison listen to on a Sunday rather than Motley Fool Money?
I can also provide policy advice.
We give it free here at Motley Fool Money.
Fully free.
Come for the financial education, stay for the political policies. All right, mate, question from Scott. Again, Scott, it would have been nice if you'd said some nice things about us. I'm not saying we have to. I'm just saying, you know, people too.
I mean, you know, yeah.
We have fragile egos that need stroking.
Absolutely.
All right. Quick question. He says, I would like to know your thoughts on the Plato Income Maximizer. PL8 is the code. Thanks, Scott. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And your simple answer is?
My simple answer to Scott, unfortunately, Scott, you know, my problem is I don't do income. So I actually have no idea about this Plato income.
You don't do income. That's good. I'll let the boss know. We can just stop the paycheck, shall we?
For income, you talk to our income expert, Ed Vesely.
Ooh, now that's a bit of a tease because we might have Ed with us next week.
Well, that's what you know. The income expert can talk about income. He knows everything about income.
Fascinating. I'm going to talk, I don't know a lot about Plato specifically. It's a relatively new listed fund. I'm going to talk broadly, though, about income. I have here's another shameless plug, Matt. It wasn't actually intentional, but since we got this question, I wrote an article for Money Magazine, which is coming out in, I think, about a month or so. So the December issue, I think it might be November, December issue of Money Magazine. And I actually talk about income stocks specifically, people looking for income. So if you are interested in income, have a look at that. Scott, though, broadly some thoughts. So I don't know a lot about Plato. I don't have a view on it. And frankly, I'd rather talk generically rather than pretend I have a well-informed view, because simply we don't do any favors for anybody if we make up some stuff and kind of have half-baked thoughts. My general view on income is you want to be really, really careful about structured income products, because here's the thing. If you structure an income product, the product manufacturer, as they call it in the trade, and that probably gives away exactly what you want to think about it as rather than someone doing you a favor, is putting together something to try and make some fees. So the first thing is, any income product is put together to earn fees from the provider. That's the first thing. Second thing is, you want to be very careful about how the product is structured. Now, we have a product we have a service at Motley Fool called Everlasting Income. We don't offer the best yield in the market on that product, right? And very specifically. So we could go out there and say, we could actually give people, man, I reckon if we tried, we could probably offer a yield of what, 7%, I reckon? If we kind of kind of selectively chose the high yielding kind of crap stocks that are high yielding because, frankly, the share prices are low because they're dodgy businesses, or if we use complex derivative trading strategies or something else, we could probably juice up to about 7% income. Now, we could do that, but we haven't. We chose not to. And frankly, by the way, the boss would be happier if I did, because we could sell more of them. If we could go out with a headline of, hey, 7.5% income, come here, buy our service. People would love it, right? The service is about 4.5% average yield, I think, at the moment, plus franking credits. So, you know, decently below that. The reason is because we've built a portfolio we feel really, really great about our members holding for the long term. And if you are buying an income product, either there's probably derivative strategies being used, so they're selling options or writing puts or calling butterfly iron butterflies or something, whatever the options.
Come on, don't disabuse my options.
I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying that, you know, these aren't vanilla income products, right? These people think about income, they think about, you know, solid businesses paying regular dividends, but some of these products are actually built out of complex trading strategies, which frankly can go against you. They may not, but they can. So you need to be mindful of that. The other thing is they often have an over-reliance on the high-yielding stocks that, as I said, aren't necessarily the highest quality in the world. In Everlast Income, we've got two bank stocks that make up no more than about 6.5-7%, I think, Doc, maybe more than that. I can't remember. Oh, sorry, we've got Macquarie as well, actually. So the two traditional banks, about 6-7% total. Compare that to the ASX, where 35-40% of the market is financials, and most income funds where they have 70% financials because the banks are paying the highest yields. That's not diversification, right? That's not safe. That's not good for anybody, particularly. It's just riskier than they otherwise may appear. I'm not suggesting anyone's misleading anybody. I'm not suggesting anyone's doing the wrong thing necessarily. Just be a bit careful about what's under the hood. So Plato, no view. But as you're thinking about buying income stuff off the shelf, just be thoughtful about how the portfolio is together, put together, what risks you're taking. Some will remember, I don't want to necessarily draw a hard link here, but back in the day, a state mortgage, for the older ones among us, was a mortgage income trust. It went broke because it just simply wasn't able to pay out the distributions that it offered. And it was one of those things that was offering really great yields. And again, I don't want to cast aspersions over that because, frankly, I don't need to go to court for anybody. But generally speaking, you know, these things can go badly if they're not conservatively put together. So just be a little bit careful of high yields. There's no free lunch in anything. And so if you're getting a high yield, assume that there are either visible or maybe less visible risks that you might well be taking. I would personally rather have a slightly lower income, but a slightly more stable and more secure, maybe even significantly more stable and more secure portfolio to go with it. Any more on that, mate?
No, mate. No, I think that covers it.
Beautiful. Let's move on. Got a question from Ben, also on Facebook. It's Facebook. The Motley Fool Australia on Facebook. Follow us, like us, send us a message. G'day, Scott and Doc. Thanks for the fantastic podcast and rants. See, that's better. see, Scott, Ben knows what he's talking about. Ben is, without any prodding from us, without any requests, without any commentary about whether, in fact, we need or like our egos being stroked, Ben just chose, out of the goodness of his heart, to tell us nice things. And that's lovely. Thank you, Ben. He says, I have recently signed up to Doc's EO, Extreme Opportunity Service, and I know the focus, as always, is long-term, 3 to 5 years plus, and the show seems to focus on stock picking. Yes and yes. My concern is, as someone who doesn't check his portfolio daily, I don't want to get too excited every time Trump makes things drop. What are your key triggers to get out of a stock? Noting you don't subscribe to a stop-loss style, and we definitely don't. Is it company news, a falling share price, a poor report, reaching a target? Thanks for any assistance and fool on. Ben, you finished in style, mate. So great start, great finish, and wonderful question in between. You know exactly what we like. Doc, tell us, I'll ask you, because he asked, he's an EO member, so Extreme Opportunities, you can join EO. If you join us at fool.com.au/MMM, you will subscribe to our mailing list of some thoughts from me and some marketing material from The Fool. One of those will be, semi-regularly, offer to join Doc's Extreme Opportunities service and my share advisor service, but if you want to join, that's the best way to do it. You get the best price that way, by the way. Doc, tell me, what are the triggers? Ben doesn't want to watch his portfolio all the time. As a professional full-time investor, what are your triggers when it comes to selling a stock?
Yeah, so good day, Ben, and you know, welcome to Extreme Opportunities. So that's great you've signed up. In a very simple world, I guess, you know, I'm horribly simplifying, but sometimes, you know, simplification is actually useful. For every buy recommendation that, for example, that we put out on Extreme Opportunities, we would say, you know, this is the thesis, right? And the thesis would be A, B, C, and D is the things we are thinking about. And these are the things how we think it may pan out. Now, you know, we think it's going to pan out like that. It actually never exactly follows that path, right? You know, because, you know, again, it's otherwise we'd be like soothsayers knowing exactly how things are going to turn out. So, you know, we we think based on what's going on, what may happen, and based on that, we make some assumptions and we think there are different possibilities. But and then we watch how the company is executing to that, and we sort of, you know, rethink how our thesis is progressing. As long as broadly the thesis is on track, we don't consider selling, right? Okay. I mean, of course, if the price gets too far ahead and then we think it's, you know, overvalued, you know, wildly overvalued. Again, the problem with valuation there too is that you can value it, but you might, you know, if you think some stock is like worth $10, but it's selling for $12, I mean, geez, you change some assumptions and it could be worth $12, right? So it's really hard in those cases to, you know, make a decision. On sort of the margin, yes, if something is like, you know, you think it's worth like $10, but it's now selling for like 50 or like, you know, 40, like, you know, it's kind of obvious. If something is obvious, again, and nothing is that obvious, actually, that, you know, most of the time, there are rare cases in which things are obvious. Mm. So in most cases, if the thesis is on track, growth is happening, we're going to stick to it and we're just going to, you know, own the stock. Now, when would you sell? You know, in most of our recommendations, we have a section called, you know, risks and when we would sell. And typically that would outline, and it's a pretty standard thing that we do with The Motley Fool. We like to outline what are sort of the key things we think in which this particular thesis could break, right? Which could be anywhere from, you know, debt that a company has and its inability to pay that debt, or, you know, maybe a, you know, geopolitical thing, or could be recession, or could be some competition, or could just be something else completely that, you know,
inability to grow at expected rates.
Yeah.
And new contracts, new deals, new research breakthroughs.
You know, some company specific, you know, or if your thesis was that, you know, your thesis was that if this and this happens, and this has happened a couple of times on Extreme Opportunities, like we had a company where we expected two things. If one of those happened, it'd be good. If the other thing happened, it'd be great. But you know, sometimes what happens, none of them happen. That is really bad, right?
Yeah.
And so when you start realizing that, you know, the thesis is faltering, that's the point at which I think you sell, right? And and finally, I'll make this point of, you know, and I tend to not sell very quickly. I'm maybe a little faster than Scott. Scott tends to hold on for long, and then there's a reason behind it. The problem really is, it is very hard to precisely make a determination when some bad news comes. So then the reason for that is, when the bad news comes and the stock price often reacts, and often stock price reacts really in a sharp fashion, right?
Right,
and then what happens is, well, the sort of the news is baked in, and sometimes it's actually overbaked, right? So you know, I generally think, you know, if a company said something, it didn't do it once, okay. It said something and didn't do it again, it's a yellow flag. And maybe three for me is like, you know, three strikes and you're out kind of thing. For growth companies is sort of the rule that I tend to follow. But you know, all rules are meant to be broken is sort of my way of thinking about it. So it makes very specific judgment. So I know this is not a specific answer, because there is no, because for every situation, every company is different. But yeah, I do watch, you know, at a higher level growth, the growth panning out and sort of the various levers that the company has, are they actually executing on that? And if I see things faltering, then I would sell.
Nice. I'm not going to have much more to that. I think Doc's covered it nicely, other than to say we don't do stop losses, because largely share price movements can be more opportunities than risks, and we don't want to be arbitrarily dumped out of a stock just because the share price moves. Where it's much better and frankly more profitable in our experience to make those decisions independent of short-term share price movements, and particularly arbitrary movements where the sale is predetermined rather than actually choosing for ourselves.
I would say that, you know, stop losses in this world of tweeting is very dangerous.
Mate, that is a very, very good summary. Hey, next question was from Adam. After the break.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Adam asks, "G'day Scott and Doc. Firstly, and of course, thanks for the great podcast and services. I have been a fool since Friday the 7th of August 2015. I love the precision. I don't know when I was a fool from. October 1998 from memory, but I can't remember the day. You?
No, I can remember like the month. It's actually not, you know, September 2010 or actually even, I can't remember, 2010, 2011. I can't even remember.
There we go. He says, since Friday, 7th of August, 2015, and has been the best financial decision I've made. How good's that?
It's awesome.
That makes us feel good. We're doing some good. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it, mate. He says, I've also listened to all your podcasts and enjoy the level-headed thinking. Must be someone else's podcast, I assume.
No, I'm very level-headed here.
Yeah,
very
level-headed. I tipped the thing over. He says, it helps me stay on top of it all. I have a question you might answer in your podcast, if I'm lucky in brackets. Guess what, Adam? Your lucky day. Unfortunately, mate, yeah, you might want to be lucky enough to win lotto or to, you know, marry a wonderful bloke or lady. And unfortunately, your luck has come to having your question answered on our podcast. So, yeah, we can't all be lucky. He said, I've recently stopped working at the ripe old age of 32 to go to university full-time. I love that. This has made my portfolio has gone from regular contributions each month to now being completely on its own for a while. I have enough saved on the side along with part-time work that I don't need to touch the invested money while I'm studying for 4 years. Good man. But I am wondering if there's anything I should do differently now that I do not contribute regular money into it other than monitoring it. It feels a bit strange or lazy not actively putting money into it and just letting it sit there. Thanks to you and the doc for the content, Adam. So, mate, Adam's been contributing for probably a decent amount of time for a look. He's a good studious investor. He's also a good studious student, which is why he's going to go and do some work at uni. In the meantime, the portfolio is sitting there with no new money coming in. How should he consider the portfolio now? Frankly, should it be any different? Or if it is, how would it be different from when he was actively adding cash to it?
Well, that's a good question, actually, and it's a hard one.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, at a very high level, this should be nothing really different, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense that, well, you still have your time horizon, which is the same. Assuming that you don't need this money, which I'm just making the assumption, but if that's the case, then there's, you know, just you just think of this as the pot of money that you've got that's invested in some stocks. You look at the thesis periodically, look at the companies. If they're doing the thing, then you keep it. If you think that, you know, I mean, one thing you can consider, and this, you know, you got to be a bit careful with this, is that you've got a pot of money that's fixed now in some sense. It's like it's a situation that people face typically at retirement, right? Yeah, but you've taken a break. And in this case, Adam, what I would say is that you maybe want to think about maybe on a yearly basis or something like that, you know, are the stocks invested in the best companies that, you know, best companies for you in terms of, you know, whatever your objectives are, growth and so on and so forth. If that's not the case, then you might look to, you know, move some money to your best ideas. So basically invest in your best ideas. And if you're already investing in your best ideas, you pretty much, you know, just monitor them and you're done. And again, you know, when I'm saying that, I don't mean, you know, if you think that you want to make some changes, I personally wouldn't. I personally don't make drastic changes right away. You know, like I tend to make changes a little slowly because that's often better. Because, you know, you make drastic changes, what happens really is that, you know, probably didn't spend enough time thinking through, you know, the pros and cons. And often, you know, we also have to realize that, you know, our ability to judge what is good. Versus what is mediocre, might, you know, we might be only right in that, say, 6 out of 10 times, right? Mm. And so if you make too many decisions, what happens your probability of success actually goes down.
Well, because you're going to be right about the sell and then right again about the buy, right? Like it actually doubles the degree of difficulty to some. It's not quite double, but that kind of idea of you get two decisions. If you're adding $1,000 to a portfolio, you've got to buy one stock and your best idea.
Yeah.
You've got to try and find $1,000 from somewhere else to add to that stock. You've got to be right that the stock you're selling isn't going to go on to deliver good wins, and you've got to be right with the one you're buying.
Which really makes it tricky, but again, I mean, you know, which is why I said that, you know, maybe on like a yearly basis is when you sort of, you know, think about that. It, you know, don't, it's something that you don't want to fuss about too much, mm-hmm. I think. That's what I, you know, I would suggest.
I like it. I think that's great advice, mate. I would probably add to that a couple of things. First is, it's always easier when you're adding more money, right? Because there's no, as you say, sell decision. There's also no tax implication of adding more money, at least at the point of adding. Mm. When you're selling, you've got to kind of, there's a couple of things going on, right? You are paying two lots of brokerage, you're making two decisions, and you're probably, if you've made some money, incurring some capital gains tax as well. And I would probably counsel you against overactivity, exactly the way Doc is, but because if you're selling, let's say you sell $100 worth of shares, you're probably going to have to pay, if you've done well, $15-$20 worth of tax on that. Now, if you do that at a capital gains tax level, assuming you're paying capital gains tax, it may be in super or something else. But if you are paying capital gains tax on that, you've kind of got your $80 you're left over with. It's got to do 25% more work just to get back to the $100 and then get some gains from there. So each time you sell, if you're paying tax, It just makes that mountain a little bit harder to climb. Now, you should absolutely sell. We'd never, ever, ever say do anything for tax reasons. If you've got a crap company or a company that seems overvalued or you've got a much, much better idea, then absolutely sell and pay the tax, right? If the 80 is going to be 50 at some point, then sell now. Or if you can reinvest the 80 and turn it into 160, well, of course, do that now. But, you know, we very rarely have that degree of insight. So I would say, as Doc said, probably, yeah, 6 monthly, annually, check for repositioning broadly, but also keep a little bit of a closer eye on the portfolio if stuff starts to go bad. So the reinvesting bit, the kind of rebalancing bit Doc's talking about, I think that's fine to do on schedule. I would just keep half an eye on the stocks just to make sure you feel good about the direction of those companies. I wouldn't necessarily want to leave it a year if company X started to go bad all of a sudden or something came out that you want to be aware of. But other than that, just try as much as you can. You're used to adding money, so you're used to kind of being active to some degree. Hopefully not a trader, but actively adding. Just maybe try and stop yourself getting too overexcited or feeling like you need to do something. Sometimes, what's the old line? I can't remember. One of the philosophers says that all man's problems stem from their inability to sit in a room quietly alone. I think, you know, if you master that while you're not working, that's probably the best way to go.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
The next question is from Paul, mate. Now, you haven't seen this one. I need to apologise to you because we are. This is real time, mate. This is live. This is real and exciting, all sorts of fun stuff. So Paul threw a question at us on the socials. This one came through on Twitter, and it came through literally just while we were recording our last podcast, actually, mate. So it's not it's actually a really challenging question, but it's not a difficult one for you to get your head around. So I'm pretty comfortable. Paul says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. I'm loving your podcasts. The two of you are very informative, interesting, educational, and entertaining." I'm sure he didn't say that because we said he had to. He just thought he would share it with us.
This is just genuine press.
So informative, interesting, educational, entertaining. That's four. Is it two each? Do you reckon which two are you?
I'll take all of them.
Which one do I get? The intro and the exit?
Yeah.
Okay. I just read the questions, Paul. He says, I'm a Motley Fool subscriber as well. Excellent. Thank you. Here's the challenge, mate. The challenge is actually for me personally because it's some of my stocks. Is I have to query why in the last few months your recommendations are all at all-time highs or near to. Why didn't they come through as buys when the stocks themselves were substantially cheaper? He mentions a couple of recommendations. I probably will not mention them because, you know, don't mind giving some stuff away, but maybe the last four recs in a row. He says, blah, blah, to name a few. I am sure they are great long-term investments, but I would much rather a cheaper entry price than close to all-time highs. Thank you both. Fool on. Now, he asked about me, so I'm going to give you your first shot at me. The last four recommenders have been around, near, at, close to all-time highs. There was a tech company there. There was a consumer goods company. There was an ETF. They're the three he mentions. They were all at or near all-time highs. He's absolutely right. Am I an idiot? Or is Paul right? Or am I right? What's going on?
You know, why didn't you find them early?
Well, that's his question, right? It's fair.
It's why didn't you find them last year or the year before or the year before? So, yeah, I'm kidding.
That's exactly Paul's question, right? It's a fair one, right? Conceptually, if stock is $15 now and it was $10 a year ago, well, Jesus, dude, why didn't you buy it a year ago? Help Paul. Help me.
Yeah. So number one would be that, you know, a year ago when, you know, somebody's looking at stocks, they might have had other opportunities that looked better at that time. Now, maybe it hasn't panned out like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and then also you have to remember that, you know, maybe a year back or, you know, 2 years back, mm-hmm. You know, the other options maybe had brighter future, mm-hmm. better price and so on. So there's always at any given point in time when, especially for our services, when we're picking stocks, I think, there are choices to be made, right? And so you're choosing from, I guess, a subset, mm-hmm. of ideas that you like, and you're giving them the best idea. And so it happened that at those times, some idea was better, mm-hmm. even if this idea was on the list. That's number one. This happens to me all the time. Number two is, I mean, even if it's an all-time high, there's a bit of an anchoring magic going on here, right? So we're anchoring to the price, the past price, and we're thinking about the past price as a basis for deciding, well, it's expensive. I know that he's not saying that, but I mean, there's this implication that, you know, it was a good value at that point. Maybe, you know, it was a good value then, and maybe it's a good value even now. While it happened good to buy it then,
Nobody knows really how the shares are going to do over, say, you know, 6 months or 2 years. And actually, it's very hard to even predict how the shares are going to do over the long term. You can only say, you know, that there's a certain probability of some things happening.
Right.
So on that basis, if the price is good and the opportunity still is good, then, you know, the price today really is the price today. And if the price is fair, then it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other aspect. To consider. So, I mean, this happens quite a bit. And then the final thing is that, you know, if a company actually is going to deliver on any thesis and it's going to be much bigger than it is today, you know, like ultimately to hit new highs, you're going to cross over the current all-time highs, right? So highs as such should not really be a problem, because in fact the reverse is sometimes a problem. That if you pick something that's going down, and if it's going down for a good reason, then you know you're just basically, you know, making sure that you're going to get your hands bloodied because you're trying to catch something that's basically going to go down further because it's just not working. I happily buy things that, you know, I buy high and buy higher largely because it's a proof of. So that the last point would be that maybe at that point, I'm just making a fictitious example, maybe 6 months ago, the price was lower, but there was less certainty. Today, 6 months back or 1 year after, the price is higher, but there's more certainty. So you're paying up more, but you're removing uncertainty, and therefore you're probably, in some sense, improving your odds of success. So it depends on what you're really trying to do. If you're trying to improve your odds of success and you want a certain amount of strike rate, what I mean by strike rate is the stocks that on average are going to, you know, or the stocks that are going to beat the market in that sense. If your target is to have sort of, you know, those stocks on average, maybe you want to be right 6 or 7 times. If that's the case, then you want more certainty. And often more certainty means that you're going to be paying up for things. So those are sort of the considerations.
Yep. I will go to my own defense slightly. I can't disagree with anything you just said, mate. Couple of things, Paul. So the first is, as Doc's already said, we can only pick the best ideas at whatever period of time we think they're the best ideas. And through circumstances, either there were other better ideas at the time, or either literally the company itself that I recommended back, say, pick 12 months ago, just pick a name, pick a date. The company I recommended that day was probably, I thought, better than the business I'm recommending today, at least at the then prices of both companies. So, you know, things have moved since. It may well be in some cases that the business thesis, to Doc's point, has played out better, and so there's more opportunity. And again, the other thing is, in a rising market, and the ASX is up 18% since December, I think, mate, or January, sorry, January 1-ish. So, you know, the ASX is up a lot. Like that's a year and a half, almost 2 years worth of gains in the space of 10 months, which is pretty good. Most things are up, right? And so you've got the choice, as you say. You know, you can try and catch the falling knife. You can try and buy stuff that's cheaper now than it was in the past. That can be great. If you find a great business beaten down, as Buffett talks about, a business on the operating table, a quality business, importantly, on the operating table, that's a great time to buy it, right? If I'm offered, I don't know, Woolies at $10, I'll take it. You know, really, really easy decision. Now, I wouldn't pay $30 for Woolies, but at $10, it's a slam dunk. Now, that being said, if you had another business that maybe was on the way out or down or in trouble, so Myer, for example, I could have bought Myer at ever cheaper prices, and I would have lost an absolute fortune for our members and for ourselves if we'd done that. And so just because it's cheaper or cheap that it has been, isn't something to be mindful of. But again, I think the bigger thing to add to Doc's point was just that fact: the market's up, most companies are higher value than they were. And if you're only looking for stuff that's cheaper than it was, that's only one way of investing. And against Doc's point, if businesses keep getting better, so Treasury Wine Estates, I'll pick one. There was one that Paul mentioned. I also, by the way, own shares in Treasury. It's a business that I think is a good business. It's got more expensive over time. Now, it's actually dropped a little bit in the last week and a half because the CEO has resigned. But, you know, when we recommended that one as a best buy now, that one was simply higher because it's playing out. The investment thesis is playing out. The market has more confidence in it. We have more confidence in it. And we think if you buy it today, you're in for market beating gains. Now, we may well be wrong, but that direction, that approach, that idea is still a really sound one. Really, the only question isn't so much where it's been, but where it's going. And if we think a business is going to do well in the future, regardless of the price, you should buy it now. If a business is going to do worse in the future, well, there's almost no price that's cheap enough to pay. You always want to be buying a quality business at the best price you can get.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
My next question is from Zach. Zach is a serial question asker. which we like because we get to be serial question answerers. And more importantly, the question was a good one. So Zach says, thanks heaps for answering my question on the podcast. Absolutely nailed it. I wasn't saying that for the sake of it. Just thank you both so much. Yeah, it's always nice to know we hit the nail on the head, mate. We're not carpenters for nothing, or at least, you know, hypothetically. Anyway, Zach says, I had another question, though. You were talking about shorting. Oh, dear. I got in trouble on Twitter this week for shorts, complaining about shorting. You said it was a business transaction because the shorter pays interest to the original shareholder, which is true. Well, why the hell would a shareholder lend their shares to someone that aims to move the price down? Surely they might make money on the interest, but won't the owners of the shares be worth 30% less when the short sellers are finished and return the shares? Good question. So basically, mate, the deal is, as we know, you can lend your shares to shorters and get paid for it. They are, in theory, going to try by means, fair or foul, to get the price down. And if they're successful, haven't you just enabled the shorters? Isn't there something self-defeating about lending shares to shorters? Why the hell would people do it?
So the interesting mechanism here is that the number of things that happened, right? So shares are, for example, if shares are held by an institution, mm-hmm. they might be held under some sort of, you know, a trustee relationship, mm-hmm. and then they might be held basically by a bank as a trustee. Well, the bank can lend it out as long as, you know, the bank is basically, in that case, the investment mm-hmm. bank is making some money in that case, right?
Investment banks.
Brokers. Yep. Brokers, if they are holding your shares, they could mm-hmm. actually lend it out because they will make some money on it.
Yep.
Some brokers tend to be nice and they actually pass on some of those fees. Yeah. So some brokers would ask you, can I lend your shares? Do you want to participate in this share lending program? And I will give you some money for it.
Yep.
In which case, you can make some money.
Right. Which is something for nothing, right? If you're going to hold the shares anyway.
Yeah. So a lot of longs actually lend out their shares on these are like big holders lend mm. it out because, hey, mm. I am long. I don't, you know, I believe in the thesis
yep.
and I'm happy to lend out some shares. So that happens. So there are a lot of reasons why people now, nobody expects. If a long is lending out their shares, they could actually call the shares if they want, or withdraw it from the lending program.
Mm-hmm.
If the alleged manipulation, for example, is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you might lend it and you might buy more shares in the market because the price has gone. A lot of things can happen,
mm-hmm.
right? So as long as you're willing to tolerate that volatility, for example, in the middle. So.
Mm-hmm.
Some reasons.
Nice. I'll throw only another thought on top of that. I think, Zach, you're asking the right question, right? And in this particular circumstance, we've had recent short activity on a couple of companies that are for high flyers. And in those cases, we've seen the share prices fall meaningfully. And you're kind of like, why the hell would longs enable that? And that's absolutely true. It's worth adding, though, that there are almost every other large company in the ASX has some short interest at some point, right? And so the fact that sometimes there's a short attack that does cause meaningful damage doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a profitable activity for everybody else most of the time. So if you've been lending your BHP shares or Woolies shares or JB Hi-Fi shares or I can't think of any others that particularly come to mind, but basically, you know, those ones that have high, what they call short interest, Harvey Norman's another one, nothing happened, right, to those shares, or at least nothing driven by the shorters. So if you were happy to lend that out, nothing happens, you get some money, then you're worse off. In fact, you're much better off because you're getting the cash. Equally, if you're a shareholder, like, again, I'll use Berkshire, mate, because it's an easy one. My apologies, Doc. I am contractually obliged, as you know, to mention it once a podcast. I kid, of course, but, you know, I like to mention it. I would happily lend out my Berkshire. I don't plan to sell Berkshire at any point in the next 2 decades, right? Now, I don't care what happens to the share price in the next 2 decades either. And even with those short attacks, if the shorters are wrong, right, even with their big falls, the 30% falls, if they're wrong over time, the share price will eventually return back to some sort of approximation of value. If you own them at price X because you think that value is fair and you expect to be higher in future, which must be by definition what you're assuming, if it's a volatile ride on the way through, you don't really care unless you have a need to sell those shares at some point or you have a shorter term hypothesis or theory. And if you do, you shouldn't lend them out for shorting. But if, you know, I don't, I've never bothered, and I probably don't, I don't like shorting, so I probably wouldn't, almost out of principle, but maybe it's costing me money, right? If someone said, look, I'll give you 5% a year, 4% a year, whatever the number is to borrow your Berkshire shares, like that's money for Gem. It's seriously, like I'm almost mad not to do it because I don't really care. The shares could halve, the shares could double. I don't care. I'm not selling them anytime soon. Maybe I do in the end, but I'm not planning to. So if I'm going to hold them for 10, 20 years, well, gee, you know, why not make some money? I don't really care what the shorters do in the short term. I'm not driven by or measuring my value by whether the shares are up or down, at least not in any long-term sense. So it's kind of, you know, why would you not? And I think at that level, it makes a whole heap of sense for short or for longs to actually do that. Because, hey, if you don't like shorters, you want to make some money from them, then everyone's happy. If they're silly enough to short Berkshire, knock yourselves out. But I'll take your cash in the meantime. I'll happily charge you rent to be short my company that I think you're wrong about. So that's kind of why. Now, in this circumstance, as you say, Zach, if there was no shorting, then there would be no probably case for those big falls for some of those companies. And I think that's a whole different conversation. I have said publicly on Twitter, on an email, that I would actually ban short selling if I was in charge of ASIC. I was flamed meaningfully on Twitter during the week for saying that. I don't resolve from that, although I don't love the arguments and the name calling, but that's okay. I don't think it's particularly useful in the market. I think people make some very basic claims about the fact that it adds some value to the market. I think on the margins it probably does, but I don't think the market is meaningfully underserved without shorting. I think it actually tends to muddy the waters and potentially cause conflicts that maybe we'd be better off without. That being said, the shorters also say, by the way, on the long side, there are still manipulators and pump and dumpers in the market. And that's also true, by the way. So I'm not suggesting that longs are always perfect and the shorts are always imperfect, just that I think a more complex market isn't necessarily better or best for market participants. Do you want to jump on that bandwagon, Doc, or you want to avoid that so you don't get flamed on Twitter?
I'm short shorts.
There we go.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Insta question. Instagram's my new favourite question to get. I don't know why. I don't love Instagram. I don't take a lot of photos. I don't take photos of food.
I'm not into Instagram.
We might Insta something. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a photo of us while we're talking and real-time Instagram it. So when you see this on Instagram, you'll know Doc and I were actually doing this live. Doc's now looking at me like I'm an idiot. I'm going to ask the question, I'm going to get you to answer it. And while you're answering, I'm going to take a photo of us and I'm going to Instagram it live because, you know, this is...
As long as you show my Apple computer, it's okay.
I'll crop it out.
I refuse to give my photo.
Can I put my Chromebook in front of it?
No.
Okay. This is a question from Mark. Back to the serious stuff. Hi, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast. Just starting out investing in shares. Good man, Mark. I have shares in ALT Resources, and they have been capital raising lately. Being new to investing, just unsure how the share price is volatile while raising funds. Keep up the great work. Thanks, and full on. Good man, Mark. Now, I'm going to guess, Doc, you're not going to suggest that investing in resource companies is a good idea?
No.
Why not?
Well, because, you know, resource companies, well, number one, if it's an explorer, then it's trying to explore and find something that may not exist.
Right.
That's a huge risk because if they don't find anything, you have nothing to show.
Okay, hang on, stop and smile.
Oh.
Smile, there we go.
Yeah, look at me. Stop.
Oh. All right, photo taken. That'll be on Instagram in a minute. This is live. This is real. We're doing this.
Live and real.
Go on.
Number two.
You actually held up your Apple Watch.
I thought I'll advertise two devices.
Oh, dude, come on.
That's awesome. So we can advertise the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch is really awesome. It takes care of your health.
All right. Mate, you've successfully managed to tangent us into Apple. Let's move back out of that. Talk about why you don't like resources.
Now we'll go back to resources. number two is, like, so I mean, explorers are like, you know, they're like hit and miss, right? I mean, if they find gold, you are gold. If you didn't find gold, you've basically got a bunch of dirt. So
that's bad.
That's pretty bad. And then on the established resources companies, I mean, these tend to be really well-run companies, right? In the established ones like BHP and, you know, Rio and so on. The issue really is that they are, you know, price takers. And when I say price takers, it means the price for, say, iron ore is essentially set in the international market. The only thing you can do is you can reduce your cost of output by, you know, using technology, being really smart, by finding the best mining methodologies and things like that. But you're still going to get only the price that the market is willing to pay for the iron ore, which would change with demand and supply. So usually what will happen is when the demand is, not keeping up with supply, when there's more demand and less supply, price goes up. But then a lot of, you know, marginal producers will come online and then the price basically falls. Marginal producers then at that point who, you know, not able to keep up with the lowering of price at that point, basically going to go, you know, either stop producing and things like that. And it's very cyclical in that sense, right? The price goes up and price goes down. Mm. Now, the good producers, though, like, I mean, when I say good producers, like, you know, people like BHP and Rio, they can operate across cycles because they would have low cost of operations and really, really efficient businesses. So these are good businesses, but you really need to understand the cycle, which is really hard to understand.
Yep.
Because cycles have super cycles and things like that.
they're impacted by, you know, like if there's a country like China, which has got 1.3 billion people, which is like rapidly growing, that is, sometimes that's very hard to understand how that can impact resources demand, right? I mean, it takes a while for people to figure that out.
Right,
so you need to figure that part out. You know, if China reduces its consumption, who else is going to take that consumption up? That's, you know, that's something, those are things to think about.
Yeah.
And then you need to be, you need to have a sense of valuation, right? You know, you should be able to value the company across these different cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you need to buy these things at the right price. And if you buy the right price, and you know, I'm not really suggesting timing, but you really need to buy at a good price.
Mm.
And perhaps sell at a good price.
So the difference, market timing is kind of trying to work out when the share prices are right. In this case, though, it's less about timing and more about understanding the kind of commodity price cycles, right? Far more than the share prices themselves. We're not trying to say, well, the charts say this or macroeconomic factors are that or it's under the 180-day moving average. We're saying if you want to buy commodities and make money, you've got to buy at a commodity price and a share price that makes sense relative to the future level of earnings, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think those are sort of broad. It's hard. Some people are really specialists in this. I don't do this at all because I can't really do it. Yeah, so I mean, if you specialize in this, that's fine. I mean, you really need to study the sector really well. Or, you know, maybe if somebody works in the sector and then they sort of, you know, are in the thick of this and they can see how the sector is ramping up or ramping down and, you know, the demand and the supply. And, you know, maybe those are people with, you know, maybe you need some special knowledge. So, it is really hard, which is why I kind of steer clear.
I think that's fair. Now, that's all. I kind of agree. Kind of adding more to that. Kind of agree more. But he asks, why is the share price volatile while capital raising is going on? Now, we don't follow this company in particular, but maybe you can just give us some color as to. I hate that phrase. Sorry, that's a analyst wanky term. Give us some thoughts as to why a share price might be volatile while capital raising is going on.
Yeah, so when a capital raising is going on, first of all, basically that means some dilution is going to happen, right? And typically, capital raising is associated with some promise that capital is going to be used in a useful way, right? So the volatility is kind of, you know, the share price probably moves in the direction of the proposed price for, you know, capital raise nearabouts that. Depends on how the capital raise is being done. That is going to be deciding, you know, is it a share placement plan? Is it an institutional placement plan? Is it a rights issue?
Right.
Are existing, you know, how many of existing people are likely to take up? And all those sentimental issues.
Yeah.
Basically, you're raising capital to do something which maybe is proven, maybe is unproven, you know, maybe. So I think it creates a level of uncertainty. Most often the price actually moves backwards because of, you know, the dilution effect and the additional uncertainty. The things, you know, there are very few circumstances in which if you're doing a capital raising, the price actually goes up because it materially changes the dynamic of the company, or people think it changes materially the dynamics of the company.
Right.
You know, it's thing, you know, sometimes, like, you know, when it's so those are the things to think about. So, yeah, often it's just the fact that, you know, there's dilution and there's like uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this, those two, absolutely. Particularly smaller companies too, mate. There's a lot of betting going on. Like, I mean, the market generally is supposed to be a kind of rough live auction estimate of the future. And to some degree, capital raising indicates so much going on, and people are trying to basically place their bets around it to see what could possibly happen next. In the perfect world, the other thing is, by the way, when capital's raised, so RFG, massively different company, retail food group, raised capital 2-3 weeks ago. And the shares were issued a lower price than the final share price because the market actually takes the average of those things. So the shares were 20-ish cents beforehand. They raised capital at 10, I think it was. So the average share price isn't exactly 15 because it's not the same number of shares. But, you know, kind of conceptually, it shouldn't fall all the way to that capital raising price because the company's worth something more. Lots and lots of maths goes on in the meantime, and it's been a bit volatile since. So, you should expect it to be volatile. Don't expect the capital raising price to be the new share price. Unless there are things like renounceable rights issues and stuff, which we won't go into now. But broadly speaking, don't assume a capital raising should give a floor or ceiling or stability to a share price.
Yeah.
Fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
You did it better than me.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, question from Lindsay on the Facebook, the book. Hi, Scott and Doc. The Motley Fool Money podcast provides a great investment learning opportunity, and you guys are getting more funnier and more informative by the week. Mission accomplished. Is listening to us backwards, do you reckon?
I don't know. Like, I mean, this sounds awesome.
Is he drinking while he's listening?
I have no idea.
Let's assume not. Question. BRKB. Now, what stock code is that again, man?
I don't know. I don't know anything about stock codes. I refuse to know what stock codes.
BRKB is, of course, the Berkshire Hathaway Class B shares. I own some of those. I should say for full disclosure, but I don't think it's a surprise when you're listening to the podcast that I own them. So I think the disclosure is probably unnecessary, but worth doing. I am a happy holder. 50% of my SMSF. Well done. He says, how do you square Warren's investment approach, Warren Buffett, Warren's investment approach in banks and airlines with Berkshire's historic growth achieved and future growth potential? Scott, I know you're a holder, but at the same time, you do not favour banks and airlines. What does Warren know that we don't? I'm loath to ask you, but because I'm supposed to include you in this podcast, I'll give you first shot at this. So I don't like airlines. I don't like banks, at least Australian banks, and that's part of the answer. Warren does. And historic growth, future growth, last couple of years have been pretty ordinary for Berkshire shareholders. What's Warren thinking that we're not? Why are we happy, or am I happy to hold Berkshire shares when Buffett is doing something different?
Okay, so I'll take a stab at this. A couple of different. So I actually won't answer the airline part because that I have actually not looked at that. Mm. Recently, somebody mentioned some of these banks to me. I actually had a very quick look. Mm-hmm. So what does Warren know that, I guess, you know, the reason we talk about our banks is our banks are basically highly concentrated. You know, we've got like four big banks and, you know, they're very closely tied to property growth and things like that. And they're also, relatively speaking, on a very high multiple relative to the rest of the world. They also got very high returns on equity. So one would think that over time, if things normalize, then there's more downside. So there's that. Right, and then, of course, you've got very high property prices and, you know, high debt and all those things like that.
So banks aren't – oils ain't oils, as the old Castrol had said. Banks aren't banks, right? Australian banks aren't necessarily the same as U.S. banks.
Exactly, yeah. So the U.S. banks, actually, strange enough, I did think about buying some banks.
Oh, no.
In fact, some of the banks
are
Buffett owned, because some of them actually look cheap.
I didn't know this in advance. You could knock me down with a feather if you said you were considering US banks.
I actually did consider because, I was going to actually use a derivative instead, but so I was going to buy a long call instead of buying the bank. But, you know, things like Wells Fargo, which I think now I can't buy them, but okay, fine, I can wait. They're not going to go anywhere. Things like Wells Fargo, actually, some of these are like in a PE of 10, and some of these, you know, are really humongous banks with really diversified business. So I think that's one. I think the price probably is the reason why Buffett is buying them. The price actually looks relatively good. That's number one. Number two is that he's got too much money, and therefore he has to buy. He should just give me some. I know how to spend them. Uh-huh. But you know what he's...
I guess he'd buy a Tesla with it.
I would just buy some cars and boats and stuff. I didn't say I'm going to invest his money. I thought I'm just going to take some
nice,
of it.
Nice, nice.
It probably won't make any difference to me. you know, he needs to buy liquid, very, very big liquid companies. And, you know, he buys meaningful stake, right? So if he wants to buy, you know, like if he needs to put like a couple billion dollars into like a $5 billion company, that's like basically a takeover, right? Which he doesn't want to do. So if he wants to have like, you know, a substantial amount of money invested in companies, they have to be big and liquid. Mm. In terms of value, which is sort of what he looks for, I think banks are a good place in the US, or at least the couple that I've looked at actually looked interesting.
Right. So
I mean, you know, they're different banks, they're different things. So I mean, he knows that, and he doesn't invest in tech, which is, I think, a mistake. But he knows something, definitely.
I think that's right. Look, really good question, Lindsay. So a couple of things going on. The first is Berkshire has been an underperformer share price-wise over the last couple of years. That's probably because the stocks that Buffett invests in, as you alluded to, Doc, aren't the companies that are making big strides on the market. If you didn't own the big four tech companies, let me go through Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, Amazon.
He owns both, and Amazon, I think one of his disciples owns.
Berkshire owns a lot, but of course different guys made a decision. But if you didn't own those, I mean, they've been the four stocks that have effectively delivered almost all of the S&P's gains, right, over the last whatever period of time. And so if you're underweight those, very, very hard to beat the market. He's also got $120 billion, I think, at last count of cash doing nothing. In a go-go market, whereas I've already said the ASX is up 18% this year. I'm not sure about the S&P, but I can't imagine it's too far different from that. When growth is in the ascendancy, Buffett underperforms. It's always been the case. And so he's kept doing that. Maybe this is the beginning of, well, not the end, but a new normal, and Buffett continues to underperform. Maybe it's more akin to 99, where Buffett was pilloried for 2 or 3 years for missing the boat, and then all of a sudden roared back into consideration with just simply the old-fashioned style that he engages in, which has been very successful. Nobody knows, but that's part of the reason in terms of the future potential. For me, it's a sleep at night stock. If Buffett's managing a chunk of my portfolio, I'm pretty happy with that, and I'll take it. On top of that, look, in terms of the doctor, he'd done a great job with the banks. Australian banks, I think, I've never said I don't like US banks. I don't know them particularly well, but I would never say that my caution about Australian banks should be applied to the US or Europe just for the sake of it. It's a very specific Australian issue here where I just don't think house prices can grow enough to make banks a market-beating investment, which is why I don't like them. But that, you know, he owns JP Morgan, which is an investment bank, Wells Fargo, which is a retail bank. Much more. It's a very fragmented banking market in the US.
Bank of America also, I think.
It does, yeah, they're right. Yeah. You're right. Super fragmented banking market, like super, super fragmented. They've got like thousands of banks over there. It's crazy. And, you know, there's different mechanics at play, different house price, different debt, all that kind of stuff. So I wouldn't do that. In terms of airlines, look, Buffett may well be right on this one. I may be wrong. But airlines have been a terrible investment for 40 plus years. Largely because there were too many airlines and too many airlines kept being added to the market. Now, airlines in the US make, if they've come to, it'd be like Qantas and Virgin here, right? Qantas have been a great investment here, by the way, for the past 2, 3, 4 years, largely because they've stopped fighting. And if you have some sort of truce where everyone makes a little bit more money because no one else is, you know, cutting out the legs out under other people because, hey, let's not discount airfares. Let's just both put them up and we'll be okay. Now, that's not an actual agreement. That would be illegal. I'm not alleging anything like that for the record. But if you do a deal, or don't do a deal. So if you just decide, hey, I'm going to stop fighting with you, and the other guy says, well, okay, I'll stop fighting with you too. Again, not directly to each other, but conceptually separately. That can be a very profitable way to go. And as long as there's no additional capacity added to the airline market here or in the US, these guys could actually go on to be quite profitable. It's when price competition comes back and capacity addition comes back, if it does, the airlines get really, really ugly. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see if Buffett and Berkshire sold those things at that point, if it happens. Like they've seen a turning point, a potential turning point, where capacity addition has fallen to close to zero and prices for airline seats have stabilized. That can be a profitable time. Time will tell whether that's an ongoing thing or not. Too hard for me. I don't, particularly in Australia. Like, again, I don't know any US airlines and I wouldn't avoid them or add to them. I don't know enough about the market there. Australian Airlines, I mean, Virgin's been a basket case for a long time. Qantas is doing really well. Does it keep going? Well, actually, it does if the airlines stop fighting with each other. Will they restart fighting? I kind of think it's probably inevitable, but I've been wrong before.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Got a question from Ajit. Now, Ajit says, love your podcast, bro. I've been called bro before on Facebook. Anyway, he says, good morning. Why do the various ETFs tracking the same index, for example, the ASX 200, have different prices? Also, how do they manage our money in an ETF? Really good questions, Ajit, and well worth asking. So we've talked about this a little bit before, mate, but there's two ASX 200 index funds. There's the DOC ETF and the Scott ETF. Yours is $500 and mine's $100. Is mine really a fifth of the price of yours?
No, they're actually relative. I mean, if they're ETFs, they should be really tracking the market very closely. So all it means is basically there's a certain amount of money. You have a certain amount of money in, and let's think of this as under that ETF, under that ETF trust.
Yep.
And you have decided that you're going to divide that into some number of units, right? So it's basically units, number of units, total amount of money. And you just, if yours is 500, you probably got, you know, maybe more money divided across a small number of units, which results in a higher price, right?
Yep.
It's basically just the function of how much money is there and how many stock units are there. And that decides what the share, what the unit price is in that case, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and if it's, depending on if the fees are close enough and if the, if it's doing a good job of tracking the index, which it should, then they should be relatively very, very close in terms of their total appreciation over time.
Beautiful. Mate, I'm gonna try and add to that by going to my favorite. What's our favorite analogy when it comes to prices?
Pizza.
Yes, there we go. Got it in one. Not surprising either. Here's the thing. If I say to you, Richard, how much is a piece of pizza? You're going to say, well, depends. How big's the piece? And I'm going to say, exactly. Now, we know that, let's take two pizzas from a Motley Fool ShareAdvisor recommendation, Domino's. Very good barbecue meat lovers, by the way. Not going to win any awards, but really, really filling. quite tasty too. It's good barbecue sauce, really good barbecue sauce. Anyway, let's take two pizzas, right? Now, you and I have a pizza each, Doc, and they cost us, these days from Domino's, well, it costs $10 because I like my maths to be easy. And I say, do you want a piece of pizza? And you go, yeah. I say, well, how much, you know? I say, the piece is $5. And you're either going to say, $5 for a pizza? That's ridiculous. Or you're going to say, $5, that's cheap. And it's going to depend on how you watch me cut up the pieces. Now, if I cut the pizza in half, $5 a piece is about right. Mm-hmm. If I cut the pizza into four and give you into thirds, $5 is all of a sudden pretty expensive for a piece of pizza, right? Because you know you get the whole thing for 10. If I'm charging you $5 a piece, then that's $15 for the whole pizza. Mm-hmm. So it depends on how big the size is. If you've got two ETFs, the Doc ETF and the Scott ETF, as I said, and they're both pizza equivalents, you're going to look at those and say, well, I'm going to pay $1 for Scott's piece because there's 20 of them. And I'm going to pay, 50 cents because there's 20 of them, sorry. So Scott's piece is 50 cents each. Doc's pieces, I'm going to pay $2 a piece for Doc's pieces because there's five of them in the box. Now, same pizza, same, I was going to say taste or style or whatever, but call it what you will, same enjoyment. But the pieces are very differently priced because they are simply different sizes. Same with the ETF, mate. If you've got some ETF might have $200 million of funds under management, that one's got $2 billion under management, very different things. And again, how many units are there within that money? Again, very, very different. You should expect from whatever price, though, they move in percentage terms in concert with each other, and that's all that matters. If you have one piece, two pieces, five pieces, depends how big the pieces are, but broadly, if a pizza is going to be double the price in a year's time, to really terribly mangle the metaphor, then no matter how much, how much you pay and how big the slice, both of those slices will double in price. The starting price is just simply not very relevant. Mm-hmm. Did I torture that one enough?
You made it a pizza.
That's what I do. Mate, the question about how do they manage our funds, it's kind of an admin question. I won't go into a whole lot of detail. Just I asked the question about, he says, well, like when I buy, do they create a portfolio from various clients like me? How's it so cheap? The answer is they simply say, well, you own effectively just a very, very small piece of that pie, right? So the fund is so big, the fund is $100 worth, you put $1 in, you own 1% of it. As the fund moves, your share of that fund moves in line with it. Same as a managed fund or, frankly, even company shares, it works the same way. Your proportional interest just moves in line with the value of the total asset, in this case, the total fund.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, next question. Probably our last one, I think, for this time. Let's see how we go. Chris on Twitter, back on the Twitters. I love Twitter.
Twitter.
Are you having a Twitter break or are you just not very happy at the moment?
Oh, I'm like, with Twitter, I think, as long as I'm just short the shorts, I'm fine. I think I'm just going to be short shorts.
All right. Chris says, have either of you heard of or used Navexa.com.au in your portfolio tracking? Can I ask what programs you might use to maintain your portfolio? What would you recommend for someone starting out investing with not much money to spend on tracking? We have asked this question before, so we won't spend super amounts of time on it. I have never heard of Navexa. I guess you haven't either.
No.
So we won't pass judgment on that one. I would say, by the way, and I have no view on Navexa, I'm sure they're wonderful people. I would be a little bit careful if I was putting my personal information into a piece of software just to make sure you know who's providing it and how reliable and reputable they are. I can imagine a scenario where someone might want to, steal your portfolio information by providing some sort of software that the data may not be secure or used well. So I'd just be a little bit careful with anyone you join. And Navexa, I'm sure, is wonderful. As I said, I'd have no slight on them whatsoever. But for something you haven't heard of, unless you've got a personal recommendation, you know how they're treating your data, just be a little bit careful about what you provide online. Mate, portfolio tracking.
So I don't do, the only thing I'm really interested, one of the things that I do is I have a spreadsheet on numbers, mm-hmm. Which is a Apple spreadsheet. Let me make that clear.
Oh, God.
I just keep track of how many shares of a company I own.
Yep.
And what is the current, I just have some other stat, what's the market cap and things like that. And what's, maybe some data about, the prices. But I don't actually keep any data on mm-hmm. on that one or mm-hmm. of my buy prices. So I don't want to be anchored to what my buy price was. I might have a rough idea, but mm-hmm. I might. And so I just look at the total value and I look at, essentially look at a consolidated portfolio allocation. That's one thing that I do. The other thing, if I want to compute returns, I basically have a spreadsheet, another one, mm-hmm. which just looks at when money was put into the brokerage account, if any was taken out of the brokerage account. Mm-hmm. And basically all I need to do is take today's date, look at, basically add up, I've got a couple of different accounts, so I add them up and whatever is the value, and then it'll compute my return. And I get the return that way. So I actually don't use any third-party software for tracking. I basically have never found it useful, and I found that most of the things that I need to do, I can actually do using a spreadsheet, and I prefer it that way.
Nice. I am lazy, and so I pay a decent amount of money for ShareSite. We have at the Motley Fool a kind of reciprocal deal with those guys where we're nice and they're nice to us. We don't provide any services to each other, but we have provided testimonials for each other in the past. So to put that on the record, I either use ShareSite. It's not cheap. I wouldn't be without it because it just makes tax reporting so much easier. Now, you have a more complex kind of life with your options and stuff, Doc, so I don't know how it deals with that necessarily. As a shares investor, I'm really happy that all of my records going back to, I think, 2006 or something I've got in there. It's all there. The prices are all there. The buy prices, the cost bases, the tax implications, the dividends. I actually don't look. We love keeping score when it comes to investing, so I really wouldn't want people to keep doing that and be careful or be aware of what you're making, where you're going right, where you're going wrong, what you're learning from that. That's super, super important. I would say, though, don't get too caught up with portfolio tracking. The last thing I actually use it for, mate, I never, ever bother actually going in to look at my portfolio returns as such, right? I know what I paid for the shares I own. I know whether they're up or down. Roughly what they paid for them. It doesn't matter because it's the future that matters, but B, even the fact it does matter is useful. Whether my compound return, I think I told you something about compound return is, and I won't do it today. It's market beating, but I won't. It's not about that. I know what it is because I looked at it the other day for the first time in forever because I was adding some trades. I made some trades last week. So I happened to notice it, but they send me a weekly email. I never open it. I just delete it. A weekly update in the portfolio is just not very useful for me to help my long-term investing. So yes, keep score by stock. Understand what you're doing. I wouldn't pay up for tracking in and of itself. I think that's more easily done, to your point, mate, outside that. I use it for record keeping and for, frankly, to make tax time and reporting and just historical data much easier to maintain. But that's just a personal preference.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
I'm going to sneak another one in, mate. I know I said I wasn't, but I'm going to because, I'm like that. We want to give extra value, mate, don't we, to our listeners?
It's a long podcast
today. I know, but here's the last one. From Russ. Russ says, hi, Scott and Doc. Love the podcast. I've always wondered, if a share is ranked 201st on the ASX and tips over to 200th, will its share price skyrocket because all the ETFs tracking the ASX 200 will be forced to buy it? Are there certain metrics that have become more important because ETFs use them as triggers? Really, really good question. So this is the rise of passive investing. I've disagreed with Michael Burry publicly, which is a dangerous thing to do. He thinks passive investing is going to blow up the market. I think it's crazy behavior, crazy talk. In any case, ETFs are bigger. They have to follow. Both some fund managers have a mandate, so you can only invest in the ASX 200, for example. So a company that goes into the 200 is all of a sudden in their investing universe, and they might want to buy it. An ETF that tracks the 200 has to buy it by definition. If a company is just outside the 200 and then goes inside the 200, now we should say there's not an automatic process, not just the 200th biggest companies. S&P, the index manager, does quarterly balances where they decide which ones to put in. They're not always purely on size. So don't try and front run that. Don't do a screen on the ASX and try and find the 201st biggest company and then assume that that'll, if it gets a little bit bigger, will drop in. It doesn't work that way. They make an arbitrary, partly quantitative, partly qualitative decision about what they want to put in. So that's the first thing. But Doc, if a company goes from outside the 200 into the 200 or any of the other indices, the ASX 20, the ASX 50, the ASX 300, the All Ords, there's millions of them. Well, there's lots of them. Does it matter? Do we care? What should we think about all that stuff?
Oh, I mean, we care in the sense that, if some investor or some, fund manager is restricted to, or their mandate is to invest in a certain index or index range, then it matters from that point of view. So basically, basically what it means is there's more coverage, more exposure to the stock. Going from let's assume the 200. So something's added to the index if it meets not just the size criteria, but it has to meet daily trading volume and float and all other conditions, right? Profitability and things like that. There's a bunch of things that I think you need to meet to get in there. When you're getting in from, let's say, as an example, 201 to 200, I mean, the impact is really minuscule, right? Because your allocation as a percentage of the ETF, something is getting kicked out and something is getting in. I mean, you're probably going to be 0.25 point, something like that, at that range in terms of percentage. It's not meaningfully
large to have any impact in terms of moving the shares because the ETFs and so on and so forth are buying them. So I think that there's some fallacy to that. The reality, though, is that what it does is it brings it into the universe of others. And if you were a small cap investor and you invested in something that was small and then, you know, it went to ASX 300, then went to ASX 200, then it went to ASX, 50, then to ASX 20. What basically happened is everything else is a byproduct in the sense that, it went up all the way there because it performed, it did well, it was a good company, not because it got there in the first place, right? So I think, there's maybe a reversal of I guess the way we are thinking about this. I mean, if a company succeeds, it grows and it gets into the index, and over time it gets into different indexes and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's not a good idea to think that you can sort of front run the index, and because something's an index, it's going to rise. Something's going to rise because the results are good. And if the results are good and the company is growing, then it becomes part of the index. I mean, but then it's not because of the index is what I want to emphasize, right?
Yeah, right, right.
Right.
So here's the thing. I'll add that very quickly to say that these things are auction markets, but they're only auction markets while the auction's live. What I mean by that is that, so here's the thing. You don't know which company's going to be added. By the time you do, everyone else does at the same time. And the chance of you getting in ahead of any other algorithm or computer to buy that stock to get that bump is almost zero. You can speculate on it, but that's not very useful because you're simply not going to know. And if everyone else is speculating on it as well, there's probably not a lot of upside in the share price. Once the bump is in, let's say there is a bump. Let's say there's a 2% bump because funds are adding to that stock, right? Because they get told by the S&P it's going in. They all jump in and grab it. Maybe there's a couple of percent in it. If you are the first one there, you're not going to be because you're not a computer. There's something. Once everyone's bought, then the share price falls about, it's going to not necessarily fall, but there's no additional upside, right? Because once the auction goes away, once all the heat goes away, all the buyers are in there all of a sudden, then they've bought everything they need. And so the buying pressure goes away again. Now, the price won't necessarily fall back, but arguably it would, right? Like if it's just a short-term bump because of extra demand, and the quality of the valuation is the same in a perfect market. It's not perfect, let's assume. Stock's a dollar, goes to $1.02 for a day while everyone buys it. In theory, if it's always worth a dollar, those, once they bought it, the new buyers on day three or day four go back to thinking, well, it's still worth a dollar. So the price in theory would or could go back to the previous level. It's kind of one of those, there's a phrase about options trading, which, Doc, I know you don't agree with, that's okay, but I'm not bagging options here, but that's where it comes from. Picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, right? Like you get a little bit of upside, but if you get rolled over, you get crushed. I wouldn't say it's necessarily exactly that, but it's a nice kind of analogy when you're referring to this sort of stuff, because basically at the end of the day, if, you know, is there a little bit of gain? Maybe, possibly, if you get lucky, if you're smart, if you're fast, if the price doesn't fall afterwards, if maybe it doesn't fall at all, maybe you don't get any benefit. It's the right thing. Like, I love the way people ask these questions, because they're thinking about stuff, which is great. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's something you can take advantage of as an investor in a reliable way to actually make money from your investing. That's probably the biggest takeaway from me.
Yeah, I think I agree.
Mate, it's Sunday. Should we go and do something else?
Yeah, should do some gardening.
I've got so much gardening too. It's summer. I've got lots of veggies planted. Look, garden looking good. I might Instagram that later too.
Okay.
If I think about it, I'll Instagram it on Sunday. I've done my live Instagramming and Facebooking and Twittering. So if you haven't already, check our feeds.
You're just helping Zuckerberg.
I said, well, you're the one bloody holding up the Facebook, the Apple Watch.
Well, but, you know, I'm not supporting the the evil empire of Zuckerberg. But
kind of are, because your photo's there, so you're indirectly helping him make money, mate.
No. I have not gone to any of those Zuckerberg enterprises.
But I'm pushing everyone out to it, so check out Facebook. Check out our Facebook page. Have a look at Doc and his Apple Watch that he blatantly threw in front of the photo.
Look at the Apple Watch.
Disgraceful. That wraps us up, mate. Before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, give us some ratings, give us some reviews, tell your friends, spread the foolish love if you wouldn't mind. Plus, you can get more from us on email, including some of those special offers to join some of our services like Share Advisor that I run or Extreme Opportunities that Doc runs or Dividend Investor run by Ed Vesely, our friend who, spoiler alert, will be here next week.
Woohoo!
It's exciting times. Go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of Foolish Insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.